When I show that in a gallery situation, I try to find a place near the washrooms and make it life-size. And I usually show it silent, actually. This is the sound that's in Corpus. When I was working on Corpus, I realized that I'd thought about this general area before when I was learning how to be an animator. And I remembered that I had made the drawings for a sequence of a person actually stretching, and I was lucky enough to find that I still had these drawings, because I never shot them when I did them, which was 56. So I shot them and used them as the very ending of Corpus Callosum, which is 90 minutes. So it made kind of a scary loop in my career and life. I thought, this is dangerous, going back to the beginning. Anyway, I'd like to show you the ending of Corpus, which is only, this is just a pinch of it. It's a minute and a half. Also, I'd like to mention that in Corpus Callosum, there's a sort of a hero and heroine that turn up in many different scenes, but they are usually different people in the same outfits. So they have a very short man, like a dwarf, wearing the same suit, jacket, and trousers, and so forth, and many different women. So the clothing itself goes throughout the film, constant shape changing depending on who it's on, and also gets involved in the different modes or games that you're involved in the contrast between what you can call realism and what you can call invention or construction. Anyway, here's the ending of Corpus Callosum with this little thing that I did. It's a 56. Yeah, I won't make any claims for the artistic quality of the little piece of animation, but it did make it a good ending in a way. It's an infinity sign, and it's stretching the way sometimes real people stretch in the film that precedes it, this ending. And I like before this is a very, very fast flashback of everything that's happened in the film up to that point. So you're going back in time in relation to the thing that you've just seen, 90 minutes of the film. But it ends up in 1956. So there's 40-odd years separating the finishing of Corpus Callosum and that little weaver, W-A-I-V-E-R. Okay, I think that there are probably other things to say, but thank you. Clear my throat. I'll try that first.
So we'll have time for just a few questions, but I maybe just wanted to start in. I think the domestic setting, a living room, is actually quite interesting, and the idea that you start with a television screen and then move into this private space, and so much about what's been discussed in the last 2 days deals with these kind of membranes between the public and the private, mm-hmm. and the way these things do just begin to dissolve into one another is quite compelling in this film, I think. But maybe, I mean, could you comment a bit on how you started with the living room setting, perhaps?
Well, there's a lot of play with the modes of belief that you have in what you're seeing. for example, the family dog, it happens to be a stuffed fox. I think that's an interesting thing in terms of metamorphosis and lineage and shapes and so forth, but it's a static animal, so the fact that it's a still but is an object within the scene is a particular layer of realism that's there all the time. And then all the stuff on the wall all has many, many different connections and histories and all that sort of stuff. And the way they move around, I think, is kind of interesting in relation to the people that are watching the television. Because you get into, without stating it, it seems to me you start thinking about whether they're really there, really, or are they inserted. And one part that I really like is the accident that happened when the nail fell out of the wall. We were trying to move the skeleton. And that just happened. And the noise was really wonderful because they just kept on watching TV. In fact, they were there. They were not inserted. The hermaphrodite was at the end. So there's a lot of fairly explicit, it seems to me, dialogue between types of belief and what you in quote realism and construction. I think that's the important thing. About, and then another level of that is the fact that you hear the director and crew essentially making, like I gave everybody the instructions. You hear my directions, and then you see the people do it. And it seems to me that that's also getting you involved in the making of the construction of this thing that you're seeing being made before your very eyes, which is another type of belief, really. So it's very sequential. It's really mostly the shape changing or metamorphosing is set against things that have to do with full and empty, or on and off, or one and zero, like all the comings and goings of all the stuff on the wall, which was all written out, actually. It took a long time to do.
One other quick question, I think, is the sound. I mean, several times in the conference, it's come up, the relationship between animation and sound. And I think there's some debate as to whether you could have animated sound, even. But maybe, I mean, given your commitment over many years to sound-based practice, I mean, how do you determine the relationship in this particular piece?
Well, there was no dialogue. The actors never spoke. The only speech in Corpus Callosum is the cast, and not the cast, but the crew and director. And in fact, I just told them, I said, I don't know whether I'm going to use this or not, but let's just record everything. Mm. So they were quite relaxed about it. Like when the nail thing happened, everybody laughed, and there was no trying to hide it, because I told them, make whatever sound you want. The other sound, since it was based on, at least not necessarily based on, but wanted to be involved in constant change, I worked out everything on glissandi, which are never stay in a certain pitch, mm-hmm. and it's a synthesizer, but it's basically sine waves that are just continuously manipulated. And so it's just a kind of shape changing for the ear that doesn't have any representational aspect to it, mm. which I think is kind of important, because the only representational sound is the sound of the director and crew, and that one point where the vase is smashed. Mm. That's the only sync sound in the entire film, actually.
Because again, that notion of expansion and contraction is really interesting, I think. Mm. in the film. But maybe we should open it up to the floor. Are there any questions? From Vivian? Yeah.
Michael, is this on?
Yeah.
Can you hear? Okay. I'm really interested in you mentioned metamorphosis and shape shifting and the constant sort of change going on. But it's also against the ground of a certain effect of repetition. I brought up repetition mm-hmm. yesterday, and it's so much a part of animation in terms of movement cycles and various things. And I'm wondering if you might address that or care to at all.
Oops, sorry.
Just she's asking about repetition within animation, and if that's a concern.
Yeah, well, it certainly is in the living room, because these same elements are well, they're used again and again in different ways, because there are patterns of coming and going. They may all go ding 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 like this, or they may go ticka ticka ticka, that kind of thing. So it's certainly an important part of it. But I have to admit that historically, it's the most fundamental animation, because it's what Méliès did. Is you shoot it, and then you take it away, then you bring it back. So a lot of that was done digitally, but still the principle is what Méliès did.
Question from Tom.
One of the things that I find really curious whenever I see this sequence is that on the one hand you have these immediate Méliès-like appearances and disappearances, and then at the same time you have the same effect of something being brought on or taken off, acted out mm-hmm. by an actual stagehand. And there's such an interesting contrast between that immediate technological disappearance and actually seeing it acted out, so that always I feel like the one's too fast. I don't mean this as it's not negative, but one feels very fast, the other one feels very slow, and you begin to think, well, what would be the right speed? And so that's impossible. But I'm just curious about that idea of having both the immediacy of a disappearance or appearance, and then the very slow kind of physical acting out of bringing it in or taking it off, which often then gets repeated and redone again and again.
Well, when the people take things out, they become believably palpable, and they have a physical identity. When you hear the chair put down, you believe in the space in a way that it might be disappearing. It might be becoming two-dimensional, which of course it really is. So I think there's just it is like two different languages, and I don't think that one, as it passes by, can identify what's different about them. But I think your description is interesting, that one is fast and clean, and the other is manual, and weight or mass is involved in it. So, I mean, basically for me, it was to bring up that believability and have it contrast magically with the fact that they can be taken away, because this is a picture, That's the main thing. It's not a room, it's a picture.
Chris, can you wait for the mic? Thanks. Oh. Thanks.
Sorry.
Hi.
Hello. It's about the relationship between the wind.
Sorry. Welcome to my cold.
I didn't know whether I'd done it. Really thinking about watching, I've never seen these pieces, so watching for the first time and thinking about the kind of mind that's developed the idea, I'm wondering to what extent your interest in your musicianship, your thinking through music, through jazz constructions, I'm wondering to what extent there's something, some quite deep relationship between musical thinking and translating that into some kind of visual form. I mean, I know it's a big theme in animation, but I'd never thought about it in relation to your work before. I'd always seen the films as about exploring narrative ideas and playing with metaphor.
I don't have anything to do with that.
Right. There you are.
Except I've only made one film that is involved with that. Sturti, it's a recent film, 2005. The other ones don't have anything to do with narrativity or narration. At least, I don't think so.
No, well, that's not the question. The question is about whether or not there's some quite important relationship between you thinking musically and the way you make the films. Yeah?
I have been interested in and have made, I think, many things that are theme and variations. And you could say about all the stuff that's on the wall in the living room that that's very musical in the sense you play this one, you play that one, and that kind of thing. Yes, I think there is a connection, but I don't want one thing to stand for the other, but I think that being a musician has affected the way I use images, but mainly it would be that the theme and variations idea, which of course is not exclusive to any idiom at all. After all, almost the best piece of music ever made, the Goldberg Variations by Bach, is an inspiration. But in jazz, playing the blues is an interesting thing because it's a 12-bar structure that's played over and over again, and new stuff comes out of it. So there are variations. It's such a subject that it encourages creative variations.
We'll take one last question. One last question.
I was just wondering, when you said that the film was intended for an audience in an auditorium, I was wondering whether that was just distinguished from the museum or whether it also was distinguished from viewing at home in the domestic setting, just given Stuart's point about the domestic setting of the film itself, whether mm-hmm. you were going to offer this for home video or... because it obviously inflects it quite differently.
Yeah. well, I think maybe... Corpus is two or three of my films I think can survive being seen on a monitor, but a lot of them really do involve the beam and the theater situation, and they really have to do with film frames and projected light on a surface, and they also are concerned with duration. It's like, you know, you don't make something. I mean, I try to make something that's 10 minutes for a reason, and so this situation is a contract that we make when we come in here. At least traditionally, that we will. We know that something has a duration, and that we will, if we like it, we will stay through the whole thing. So things that have beginnings and middles and ends are not generally appropriate for a gallery installation. So some of the films, like La Région Centrale, is 3 hours. And to really get something out of it, you should see the 3 hours, because it's cumulative. What happens, it's even physiological. It affects your sense of gravity. And there are all kinds of things that happen about the idiom of this particular world that you're in for the moment that have development. And so it really shouldn't be compressed to just some kind of illustration if you want to get everything that's possible out of it. So some things I've been resisting making DVD copies of them. In fact, I did a self-vandalization. Several people seemed to want to see my film Wavelength on DVD, and so far I've refused. And I 3 years ago I made a DVD that can be purchased. I don't have any on me right now, which is called WVLNT, Wavelength for Those Who Don't Have the Time. Originally 45 minutes, now 15! Exclamation mark. And so I just cut the film in three parts and superimposed one on top of the other equally. So you save a half an hour. it's actually not bad.
Okay, we are running over, so if we could meet back at 3:15, that would be great. Welcome back. Hi, welcome back. We have reached our final session, sadly, and I think both speakers are going to probably intersect with many of the points made already and no doubt draw us to some interesting and hopefully open-ended and productive conclusions. I couldn't help but think while we were watching Michael Snow's Living Room as the couple, actually, sorry, it wasn't Living Room, it was the subsequent
film, but when the couple kind of merged into a sort of consolidated cube and began to walk, it looked a bit like a cryogenically frozen Walt Disney. Which brings us to Esther Leslie, whose book Hollywood Flatlands was an absolute watershed moment for me in terms of rethinking animation and how it might apply. I think it takes the old formula of looking at, you know, high and low art and totally turns it on its ear and makes it, frankly, far more interesting and complicated. Esther's also written not so long ago for Tate, Etc., our own publication, on the occasion of our Kandinsky show on Oscar Fischinger's work, and most recently a really brilliant publication on color and synthetic color called Synthetic Worlds, Nature, Art, and the Chemical Industry, which is also highly recommended. So Norman Klein will follow her. I'll introduce him just before he speaks, but please welcome Esther Leslie.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me here. I'm trying to get at something here, and I may have got it wrong, so this is an essay in the literal sense of the word, and it's imageless, partly because of copyright. I was unable to circumvent copyright control on commercial DVDs on my home equipment. Partly also the absence of imagery might help you to focus on the intricacies and inconsistencies of the argument. So it's called Liquid Animation and the Freezing of Reflection. Contemporary animation has an affinity with fluidity. The spectacular swirling and gushing of fluids is the benchmark of effective CGI modelling. The fluidity of the animated water is indexed to the inspirational flow of creative solutions in software processing studios, and not only in PUFs, such as that by Hewlett-Packard in relation to its Linux-based solutions for DreamWorks, Sinbad, Legend of the Seven Seas, where the new techniques of animating water are described as making waves. Only CGI, it would seem, can effectively imitate the complex physics of fluids, as Aardman Animations found out in their film Flushed Away, eschewing plasticine modelling and stop motion for computer generation. There's a pull in commercial digital animation to parade studios' technical abilities through computerized renditions of the natural sublime, in which water plays a central role. Kant's sublime was evoked in the viewer by the sight of the mass of shapeless mountain masses piled on one another in wild disarray with their pyramids of ice or the gloomy raging sea, so he said. Wild nature, the swirling sea, massive ice flows, a looming dark snow-capped mountain, a sudden chasm, provokes in the viewer a welter of feelings, most notably a type of terror as the mind realizes the immensity and indifference to humanity of that which is perceived. Recent computerized animation has pushed technique to simulate this or just such a spectacle of wild nature. Countless SIGGRAPH papers testify year after year to efforts to model the wind-driven accumulation of snow, the complex fluid dynamics of floods, tsunamis, and turbulent splashing water, ripples on the surface of ice, and the vortices of superstorms. Photorealistic modeling of natural phenomena is the desideratum of animation. Not just the look of nature, but also its behaviors are recreated. The antiphysics that arguably was originally intrinsic to cartoon worlds seeds way. Leading digital animation studio Blue Sky boasts about the theoretical physicists on their staff, which enables them to use Newtonian physics, albeit stylized to comic effect. Once effective techniques of nature simulation are devised, they translate commercially into dramas whose plots act as segment by segment pretext for illusion showcasing. So recent animations have been set in oceans or amidst the frozen waters of icy, snowy landscapes. These zones, perhaps the backdrop or envelope for over-lively dancing penguins, incarcerated clownfish, or dolphins choreographed underwater. Examples include child-oriented animations such as Ice Age and Ice Age The Meltdown, Happy Feet, and this summer's Surf's Up, as well as ostensibly real-action disaster films, such as The Day After Tomorrow, which renders digitally the turbulent, unstoppable waters of the floods, as well as immobilizing the whole northern hemisphere under a sheet of ice. The logical destination of photorealistic modeling is to prove itself, which is to say to make its fictions invisible in the photoreal context of live action. The oceans of pixels, panned over as light rays seemingly glint off their swirl and flow, are worlds different from the ocean that Vertov ripped up, as Tom told us the other day, in a sober rejection of romantic contemplation. This is one form of the pervasiveness of animation today, which means to see it where it may not have been seen before, where it may not want to be seen, but where it's omnipresent now in live action. There's something figuratively and literally polar about developments in computer animation. The films mentioned represent, often as part of their narrative, shifts, frequently sudden, between two opposed states, the fluid and the frozen, gushing water and snowy, iced-up wastes. The water is often, as occasioned by the narrative, mobile, overly so. The snow and ice is, in contrast, static, immobilized, and immobilizing. In this dual representation, the very stuff of animation is addressed or reflected, for the question that animation poses again and again and answers in its various ways is, how does a concocted substance or thing that is apparently inert, frozen, begin to move, become fluid? The fluid and the frozen, the jump between these two states, is the synecdoche of computerized animation. As physical states, these two reflexes of the dynamic sublime, the frozen and the fluid, are zealously rendered or simulated more or less effectively in CGI and mediated as narrative ciphers on the space of the screen. This narrative and technical drama of tumultuous change is represented in sudden rifts in the ice or the unstoppable roll of flooding waters, the sudden uncontrollable movement of a character skidding down an icy chute or caught up in the inexorable force of rushing water. Of course, the motivation for sublime stories about melting ice caps and icy chasms is not only technical, but also political, ideological, mapping current doxa about global warming and ecological catastrophe. The devastating effects of global catastrophe in The Day After Tomorrow, for example, play out a human horror scenario, and the effectivity of this vision is reinforced formally in the dialectic of animation and its opposite, de-animation, the sudden and excessive movement of natural forces, the melting of a vast glacier, is counterbalanced by immobility and death as the snow blankets cities and the banking of massive snow piles and glaciers in a sped-up ice age paralyzes life. As a narrative device, the shift between the fluid and the frozen recapitulates the phylogenetic and perhaps ontogenetic development of CGI, in demonstrating through emulation how the relative simplicity of a consistent and durable form, something immobile and unworldly, transforms into the complexity and chaos of physical phenomena, something that moves in a plausible world. This it does through its techniques of layering, compositing, texture mapping, pixel tweaking, and rendering. The layers of the CG image, the processes of accretion at work on the image, could be seen through the metaphor of snow, if indeed such technical processing could be seen as some sort of freezing of the image. Layers, the envelopes or wrapping of texture mapping, are like the falling and compacting of snow. An image of these processes might be perceived in the theatrical poster for The Day After Tomorrow. A familiar vision of the skyscrapers of New York is suffocated under a thick layer of snow. The city is draped, muted, the people invisible. The city is deanimated through animation, its fluidity frozen. At the same time, the screens that have developed to showcase these sublime effusions have their own liquid and frozen referent, liquid crystal displays, for one, compel into one the binary of fluidity and solidification. The screens also participate distinctively in animation. The plasma in plasma screens refers to high-temperature, deionized, phosphor-coated particles, but its root meaning comes from the Latin for molding, forming, shaping, a type of drama of animation in itself. The word plasma has fluid connotations in other contexts, in biology or popularly in plasma lamps. The very screens themselves act in the drama of animation. These technologies of display, along with DVD technologies, are renowned for their ability to display super smooth movement and the inviting capacity to immobilize the image as the preset picture freeze function suggests. The digital sublime and the new screens have collaborated in showcasing each other's capacities for some time. The demonstration films for the new generation of buyable screens in store depict underwater scenes, or literally sublime, high, exalted, under the lintel, aerial pans across mountainous landscapes. The natural sublime, digitally modeled, texture mapped, composited, and rendered, on the other hand, presents an uplifting or dreamlike submersion in striking fields of unfamiliar space, forms, and colors, photorealistic, but without easy comparison in real-world experience. At other times, the demonstration films display scenes from the latest digital animations in a more or less sharply parallel display of pixel on pixel. It all began with Shrek and Monsters, Inc. These particular cartoons were used not just because of their eye-catching cuteness, but also because of their, for the time, remarkable vividness in modeling 3D, their supersaturated colors, and their sharp syncing of motion and sound, so innate to cartoon worlds from the start, but intensified by digital processes. If new screen technologies can only translate a percentage of the color content and light energy perceptible to the eye, then digital animation's complete control of the limited color palette of red, green, and blue offers a way to best inhabit such limitation. The new displays are touted for their ever higher definition lifelikeness, but their perfect output is the least realistic, most processed binary confection of contemporary digital animation. The situation bears similarities with that of the 1960s, when Walt Disney helped promote and therefore sell color TV in the United States through his show Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, broadcast by the NBC network because its parent company, RCA, manufactured color TV sets. Indeed, it could be argued that blockbuster computer animations are showcases for technical processes in their guise as newly purchasable technologies as much, or rather than, coherent, self-contained entertainments. The screen itself becomes concretely the location on which the animation plays. The animation cannot be thought without its mode of mediation. Technology precedes the image as well as infusing it thoroughly, but it naturalizes this relationship too. It's a new stage in Walter Benjamin's idea of cinema as the thoroughly mediated presentation that does all it can not to present itself as such, appearing as an equipment-free aspect of reality, which is, in actuality, the height of artifice. Reality, as mediated in film, he says, is cut into by the surgeon cinematographer, then stitched together again in more or less visible sutures. In digital animation, the calculated generation of an illusion of the real, or at least a plausible field of action, is even more thoroughly permeated by technique, just as it concentrates efforts to make those processes imperceptible or visible only in their wondrous invisibility. A supervisibility of animation, its in-store pervasive garishness, a supreme vector of the new techniques of seeing, is accompanied by invisibility, the imperceptible post-production techniques that are a part of almost every film today. Recently, animation has taken on a new pervasiveness because its presence is now crucial in most real action cinema, which is now subjected to post-production digital techniques. Animation perfects the extant, that is its current charge. Animation, digital or possibly otherwise, allows an endless and absolute manipulation and revision of material. Its objects are boundless, formless. Its universe is infinite. This is a type of excerpting of film from time, which is something I want to go on and look at further. Specific to digital creativity and processing is compositing, the interlocking of CGI with real-world activity to institute an ideal reality. Where historical action was, where time was, Now there is a stillness of the digitized simulation, tweaked frame by frame and propelled into action, replete with CG motion blur. To achieve such perfected simulation requires immense machinic power. Alongside renditions of Kant's dynamic sublime of wild nature, the drama of animation participates too in his mathematical sublime. What is awesome in the contemporary animated scene is less the overwhelming power of nature and more the dislocating alarm at the incalculably large data objects, whose efforts are directed towards the replication of something like it, which already exists and is in its doubling of the real that its success or failure is measured. And the mathematical stakes of this doubling increase constantly. The necessary calculations undertaken by machines, not humans, overwhelm sheerly by existing and exhaust human mental faculties if humans should try to count and get caught into an almost infinity of sums. These confections are measurable in gigabytes, terabytes, or future yobibytes of data, but like the non-human scale of cosmic time and space, they may not be aesthetically intuitable to sense. In this placement beyond sense and rational intuition, the digital film's procedures might appear to be the result of magic rather than surgery, or at least its fake, erratic form of magic, which willingly takes on the name industrial light and magic. I noticed how Johnny Hardstaff yesterday spoke of conjuring up the real in CGI. I think we hear that quite a lot. A recent technique bestows a kind of magical impossibility on the image by playing with or inside this binary of the fluid and the frozen that I hope to have presented as at the heart, at least, of contemporary film and most specifically animation. Tim Macmillan's time slice, or other types of frozen time processes, mobilize the still moment, frozen in time, into movement through space, but disconnected from the temporality of the image, if not from the viewer's time of experience. A moment is arrested as multiple stills cameras encircling an object simultaneously click through possibly 360 degrees. Transferred to a computer, these images are then stringed sequentially, rendering a still object animated, or stretching out a single moment temporally, or rather packing a non-time into time itself as time turns spatial. In frozen time, viewers appear to be moved around an object frozen in its instant. Audience mobility meets objects freezing. The procedure is now as familiar in films and TV programs, especially nature documentaries, as in advertisements, where the fetishism of a temporary, viable object overabundantly and overachievingly occupying its allotted time appears attractive to branders. Witness for just one of many examples, the Time Slice, Tim Macmillan, Mark Ruff collaboration on a German McDonald's advert where an exploding lettuce was circumnavigated, caught by a digital rig of 50 cameras. In fact, in a reinforcement of the metaphor of freezing and fluidity, Tim Macmillan's Time Slice website testifies to a veritable tidal wave of the frozen time effect in TV commercials and feature films. A variation of the technique is bullet time, characterized by its expansion of a moment in extreme slow motion in order to present imperceptible events, such as a flying bullet, which is coordinated with cameras circumferencing the scene at what could be a normal filmic speed. Again, the frozen and the fluid are brought into sudden proximity, but not as not a mediated proximity. This has been used in film as well as in computer games, such as the Max Payne series, or Enter the Matrix, and The Path of Neo. In gaming, this technique enables players to slow down the game world while allowing them to look and aim at normal speed. Frozen time effect technologies stretch out a single moment, arguably not in order to gain further knowledge of it or of the thing represented through an enforced period of reflection, as was the argument of Eisenstein's intellectual montage with its dissection of time and combination of multiple perspectives. Rather, it's a stunt, and it's used for stunts. The photographic booty is seen from all sides, panoptically. In gaming, it exposes the moment to the decision to shoot, armed with the advantage of the shooter, the viewer, being outside time and so invulnerable. The look of the frozen time camera is a fetishistic look that meets well also with the purposes of advertisers. Another more benign version of this is also well used in documentary film in a technique whereby a foreground figure is excerpted from a photograph and disassociated from the background, and then via some sort of computer trickery involving focus and simulated depth of field, a fake parallax is effectively offered. Once this is achieved, the camera pans in across a field, now rendered apparently more lifelike. In general, the spatialization of time in time slice and bullet time and similar processes does not remediate its own interruptive nature. It excerpts a moment from the flow of narrative, only to re-embed it in continuity aesthetics and the reinforcement of a bodily presence that appears utterly without technological support in a three-dimensional space of old, which masks any awareness of its utter non-presence, its dependence on the virtual space of the camera composite, as well as its projection of the viewer into an impossible position for which there is no readable narrative support. It induces, arguably, in its synthetic confection, an experience of wonder, the sensation of a digital sublimity, a sublime transcendence, as the audience is lifted from the moment or allocated an impossible temporality. In these processes, the fluid may well be frozen by the machinery. That it does not wish to create something flowing or akin to life can be anecdotally attested. When Tim MacMillan, the inventor of the time slice camera, first showcased his technique on the BBC science programme Tomorrow's World in May 1993 in a sequence called Dog, many people, so he claims, phoned the BBC distraught because they thought the dog was dead. That this was not an arbitrary association might be discerned in the fact that 5 years later, in 1998, MacMillan used the technique in a gallery installation cum video projection called Dead Horse. A horse, its legs splayed, all hooves lifted off the ground of the abattoir, its muscles tense, is confronted by a rifle, and the bullet of the rifle has lodged in the horse's head at this moment, the stretched-out moment of death. The camera's witnessing the split second that splits life from death, animation from deanimation. The moment of death may be experienced as repellent or chastening in its display, but unlike with Edison's electrocuted elephant, who we saw, we move around the scene, we transcend it, and it becomes arguably an aestheticized object of contemplation for us. The conceit was repeated in 1999 in Ferment, as once again the moment of death is captured, and a panoptic circling of people and objects in a snatch of time is rearticulated at another level as the city itself is panoramically scanned so as to make possible that, the way in which, as the Animate website puts it, the human condition unfolds in glimpses of frozen moments. Death is deanimation, here counterbalanced rhetorically with the reference to the human condition, and counterbalanced at the end by the arrival of new life at the close of the film, after which the flow of life presumably can resume. The freezing of movement and time finds its polar opposite in another prevalent computerized image practice. One of the technical ways in which animation settles nowadays in image production, a very popular form of image production, is through the preset processes that come with image manipulation software. The Ken Burns effect, for example, in iPhoto, iMovie, or Microsoft Photo Story. This is an introduction of movement into the frozen stillness of the personal photo archive. It's an animation of real-world referent materials. This is animation's pervasiveness in a third category, not animation film cartoons, not live-action fiction film, but in the one place where it might least be expected to be adopted, in documentary. Ken Burns is renowned for his documentary style, which worked intensively with this technique, embedding photographs into films and introducing movement back into the archive of static photographs of jazzmen and American civil warriors through panning and zoom-in across photographs and deploying fades or other transitions in order to introduce some sort of mobility between the artificially enlivened frames. Animation, in the sense of giving life, is thrust on the past technically. The always threateningly past and frozen life of the archive is willed into fluidity, extended through a digital resuscitation. Where there was stillness, there shall be movement, an illusion of life. In the process, vectors generate the simulation of movement above, around, and within an insurmountable stillness. To animate photography with the illusion of movement is not to analyze, but to produce a kind of pseudo-experience, as if giving you more knowledge. Panned photography brings fluidity into the static as an imposition from the outside, an effect of the machinery, which can be said, of course, of all film, though differently, for film is a translation of one-time real movement in the world through immobility back into mobility. The animating techniques are developed to counter the numb stillness of the archive, suggests we're not supposed to face the past in all its frozen closeness. This process could be on a par with the coloration of black and white movies or the desperate search for color film of Nazis and so on in the historical archive in order to communicate, to make it more real, more realistic and seeable than the duotone stuff. Perhaps it's akin to the use of music in early film. Adorno wrote of how in film, music lends a cinematic vision, a veneer of humanity, a semblance of liveliness, for it masks the whir of the projector in the background, the proof that we exist under the sway of mechanization. Without it, we're blankly exposed to our counterparts, the two-dimensional shadows that cavort on the screen, as Adorno and Eisler observed in composing for the films. Film's original configuration is stillness whirred into movement by the energy of the projector. In this illusioning, a simulation of actual, even if fictional, past historical activity is achieved. Movements caught on celluloid overcome their freezing into frames to be rendered smoothly mobile again. Some filmmakers, for example Vertov, exploited this fundamental basis of film, arguing that to return film to its component stillness is to make it available for analysis by making it conscious, by making the move between the frozenness and the fluid conscious. Vertov, too, then uses a spanning between the frozen and the fluid, but enacts this such that the passage from one to the other is the unoverlookable theme of the drama. Likewise, Walter Benjamin's optical unconscious of photographic technologies involves an arrest of the flow of movement, such that the camera vision's complete and indiscriminate recording of a whole field can, in retrospect, be scrutinized for chunks of actuality that translate into knowledge. This is knowledge for the audience, witness to that immobilization of flow into static frames. The span of frozen and fluid, I would say, works differently in CGI, perhaps then barring its creations to the modernist mode of recognition, and that I'd like to just explore as I close. In CGI, film's original configuration of frozen frames mobilized into movement and fluidity is recapitulated in a new visual production field where computers freeze the scenario in order for filmmakers to manipulate contours and through the spatial practices of modeling, compositing, texture mapping, rendering, pixel tweaking, layering, digitally repropel it into movement. But is an optical unconscious lurking there to be rediscovered? The details caught in photographs by the camera's optical unconscious are made available to vision in old-style film through the coincidence of chance that they were there and needed not be seen by the human eye at the time, and the pressure of the here and now, an uncalculated detonation of something in the present, brings the optical unconscious into being, Through this, photographic details are blasted out of the flow and brought to life via intellectual reasoning. In this move, it is technology in its medium-specific procedures that salvages something of the real. In addition to this, the machine emulates the unseeable that is the human unconscious. Benjamin aligned via Mickey Mouse, the camera's unconscious, with the audience's neurotic, psychotic, and dream states that plumbed social fantasies and fears and found representation in film. In CGI, in contrast, there's a different accord of human and technology. Human mastery is effectively enabled by the machine. Made visible is the already visible in a doubling that parades technical powers. Ironically, this technical permeation of the material reinforces in the end a distinctly human control, which turns film into painting, a certain kind of tendentially realist, if possibly romantic, painting, rather than the frequently self-unmasking drawing that was the original basis of animation. The current attractiveness of this transformation of film into painting via digital processes might be seen in films such as the Rotoshop Waking Life or A Scanner Darkly, one of which uses the pretext of a dream state, the other drugged visions, to legitimate narratively their painterly embellishments of the real. And in Benjamin's complexes, painting is aligned to magic, so there's a sort of evocation of magic in that statement. I'm concerned, I think, with the polarities of fluidity and freezing. Early animation investigated, deployed, and mucked about with disjuncture, interruption, or montage. Both of these poles, or movement and stillness, had to be thought at once, as Benjamin indicates in his phrase, dialectics at a standstill. The frozen and the fluid had to be discovered in each other rather than counterposed as polarities. Benjamin, leaning on the theory and practice of Brecht, spoke about film as a flow that had to be interrupted, and Brecht's dramatics demonstrate for him both the valuing of flux and ceaseless change, and also epic theatre's idea of breaking up the flow of interruption, slicing the narrative into scenes and the scenes into gestures. The insistence on a kind of inevitable transformation, the flow of time, the flow of history, meets the demand for analysis. Analysis means to break up. History, the passing of all things, and agency, the decisive moment of force, are preserved in Brecht's method and appreciated by Benjamin. If the two aspects are brought together, revolution is the prospect. In splintering representations by analysis, the possibility springs up of worldly reconstitution under new laws. New constellations gel. Historical stasis is melted. Marx and Engels spoke of revolutionary activity in these terms, all fixed, fast, frozen relations with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions are swept away, all new-formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. In that metaphor of social transformation, the development of capitalism and its beyond, there's a permanent exchange between fixity and fluidity, not a flipping back and forwards, but a mediation that is itself historical movement. I voiced through this paper a Brechtian and Benjaminian distrust of the sublime effect as something contemplative, shattering, but unusable for historical acting. I want to end by mentioning another type of sublime, sublimation, in a chemical sense. Water can sublimate in a chemical sense. Ice converts to gas without passing through the liquid stage. You see it in old ice cubes in your freezer, smaller than they used to be. And you see it in freezer burn and in snow during a cold spell that vanishes gradually without ever melting. And when dry ice, that ultimate spray-on sublime technology, is placed in water and solid carbon dioxide quickly becomes gaseous carbon dioxide. The most famous line from the Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels follows the one just quoted in German, alles Ständische und Stehende verdampft. In its rather poeticized English translation, it is all that is solid melts into air. This is about the rapid process of modern development. It harbors no romanticism about inherited forms plowing ahead in the dialectics of a constant class struggle. In it, process is at work. The metaphorical complex that I want to evoke, or that modernist or other non-digital, shall we say, film technologists suggest to me, is a different one to this polarity of the freezing and the fluid, because the technology's aesthetics and the inherent politics are different. It's to do with melting, or, as the situationists put it in their sketching of revolutionary process, defrosting frozen time in order to enter into history. For Benjamin, it's a question of representations gelling the motive forces in a situation. Defrosting, melting, gelling, these are the transitional states. They're between the fluid and the frozen. They work through time, not space. They may not be technologically, aesthetically, or politically available to digital film worlds. And as Johnny Hardstaff says, discuss if you want, or just ignore. But anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Esther. That's great. When I first moved to Los Angeles in the early 90s and was trying to make sense of this bizarre, horizontalized, celluloid void of a city, luckily I was handed a copy of Norman Klein's The History of Forgetting, and suddenly things began to make a bit more sense. Discussed the city in terms of things like erasure and phantom limbs, and it connected quite interestingly to his previous publication, 7 Minutes, The Life and Death of the American Animated Cartoon. Many of you might have read his more recent book, which is equally brilliant, The History of Special Effects, The Vatican to Vegas, The History of Special Effects. It's one of the icons of literature around scripted spaces, narrative environments, and a lot of these phrases that we now accept quite commonly. But I do think Norman is a pioneer of this kind of thinking, so please welcome Norman Klein.
We're going to race along. Let's start with the first slide. We have a half an hour. I have a lot I want to show you. I had all these notes, and now they seem irrelevant. I'm staring at you, so let's just get started, right? I'm going to concentrate on this principle of animation applied to space itself, whether it be a scripted space, or whether it be a layered space, or whether it be a kind of phenomenological or psychological space. By a scripted space, just for clarity, a scripted space is a designed environment where the purpose of the design is to give the viewer an experience like a story where they are a central character. In other words, a slot machine or a shopping mall or computer games, obvious example. This is a show that I was involved in. It was called Scripted Spaces. You could see Bad Luck Blackie, the Tex Avery character who has endlessly bad luck, in the bottom. Each of the cells is 9 feet wide. When you walk through it, heading toward the Palace of T.I., that Giulio Romano painted on in the 1520s to sort of show a special effects illusion of titans destroying the building, you get lost inside, you become this dog with bad luck. As soon as you photograph it, you become a movie. So it's part of the whole crisis. In front is the Labyrinth of Versailles, which is a rather famous example of a scripted space. I don't know if it succeeded because they kept forgetting to put the dog in there. People didn't understand what was going on. It's been done various times. It gives a sense of the problem that film is a point of erasure, not a point of discovery. It gives you a distraction as much as it gives you an actual social present experience. Complicated. Let's just move. We're on a race here, right? We'll move to the next one. This is you. This is the Colosseum, as in the word colossal, It was a panorama in the 1820s. In Regent's Park, as London would look from 20 miles around from the top of St. Paul's, right? So here we are, yes? And then if you look at the basic shape in the center, it almost is a kind of dream of a skyscraper with steam-driven elevators as well. Let me show you the next slide. Next slide, please, quickly. Raising along. Well, can you see us? I think we're somewhere. Anyway, this was a sense of the view inside. These are Tom Gunning and I were talking about this. Very famous images, but they're a lot of fun to see since we're looking at ourselves inside a building of ourselves that's not there yet. You know, very logical, animated experience. And the next one, this is the same shape reappearing in dozens and dozens. It's almost like a Close Encounters experience. This is a hangar for a Zeppelin. You can see it in the Sony Pavilion in Berlin. You can see it over and over again. In the next image, you'll see it blowing up. Of course, yes, endless. it's like a haunted space that doesn't exist. It's a phantom of the building that was never built, you know? The Chutatlin's Tower. But I'll keep moving. Let's go along. This is 1889. Another version of a kind of immersive scripted illusion at the Paris Opera House. It's the Ride of the Valkyries, done mechanically and industrially for the audience at the Paris Opera. We can try the next slide to get a better sense. There it is. Is that amazing? Mechanical figures riding across the sky in the Paris Opera. The next slide will give you a sense of what it looked like. So don't tell me we have to wait for Steven Spielberg. I agree with Siegfried. And it's not a question of beginnings or endings, right? It's a question of it just keeps happening. But what does it mean in its context? But I'm moving along. We must move along. Yes. Next. This is a curiosity. It's a version to scale of 15th century Paris, done by Albert Robida, who became famous as a kind of science fiction illustrator, for the 1900 World's Fair, with a tour bus of sightseers waving to the 15th century that doesn't exist in the year 1900. And they could visit it as well. I was going to, if I had time, read a bit about, I have a little book, Freud in Coney Island, that came, that I published last year, where Freud goes to Coney Island one day. No one knows what happened, except I do. I thought about it. I said, I know. You know, we know he had indigestion. We know he had a case of diarrhea in New York. He and Jung. We know that he probably, with his bourgeois tastes, would have gone to dreamland most of all. So we imagine him walking underneath the strange haystack scale. Breasts of this large plastered woman, and it was designed so that you almost walked in through her vagina into dreamland. So I have this long description of what happened, but I have a few copies of the book I brought, so if some people want to get a copy, you know, it's like a little foretaste, right? After all, we'll pretend I read it, and we'll keep moving along. If there's time, we'll go back to it. This is the Scintillator. Interesting. It was for the 1915 World's Fair in San Francisco. 48 lights across San Francisco Bay in 7 colors on a barge. How's that? I love the fact that it's black and white, don't you? Because the most powerful process, we don't want to forget that what this whole conference I feel is about is indeed the spaces between the mental journey, the places of correspondence, not illustration and sort of casual connection, but the actual mental process that is the nature of narrative, and maybe that's what we are afraid we're losing in this strange peanut butter-like, horizontalized, flat world, whatever you want to call it, global economy. Oh, this is cute. This is in Vernon, California, near downtown Los Angeles. It's a giant mural around the street of pigs happily moving to slaughter. It's called Hog Heaven, Les Grimes. In fact, he died on the scaffold trying to continue with the pigs, and they trained someone to keep painting those very weird-looking pigs, and they're still going. So you can walk around and join with the pigs and pretend that you're becoming a sausage, and then buy a sausage afterward. Or go to the supermarket. And then this is an image from 1936 of a novel imagining what the workstation of 2005 would look like when you could time travel back and forth. So this is the workstation imagined 70 years ago with a time traveler just walking onto an oriental rug. It has endless sort of echoes that you see of movies that came and went, movies that never were done, technologies that almost appeared, echoes back to the Baroque, and so forth. Anyway, but what I... if we stay there for a moment, I have two projects to show you. I'm going to try and stay on rhythm here. The first one is a database novel entitled Bleeding Through, based on four pages from the History of Forgetting. Oh, wait, no, not the other one. Bleeding Through, sorry. That'll be the next one. That'll be the imaginary 20th century. We're not ready for that yet. So we'll enter that and see what happens. Oh, can we start? All right, we'll use that image. That's good. That's good. It's called Bleeding Through. It's a story of a woman who I see her in the 1980s at first. She's this peaceful old lady, and she... Maybe I should let myself explain. She apparently murdered her second husband, but no one can prove it, and she doesn't care. So it's a journey of 1,100 images back and forth through versions of her life in three tiers. Well, let me explain for a moment, very briefly, in one of the chapters, and I'll show you some of the images.
Here, when she moved from the old town, unfortunately,
seem to want to talk. Well, okay, I'll speak for myself if I have to.
Noticing that he's been adding to his harem of women, and he has this girlfriend who's so a little rounder, fuller lips, nice eyes, got a kind of cute manner, not too clever. She begins to realize that her chances are not very good. There she is. She's living in Jewish neighborhood, Los Angeles. She gets a job as a bookkeeper in a clothing business.
Uh-huh. Well, you'll have to learn the rest of her story later, I guess. Let me go to see what else is. It's set up in tiers and chapters, and that's the first chapter, and the first seven chapters are the last memory she has before she dies, the last days that she remembers the best. Two fairly rotten husbands. The second one disappears, not so much mysteriously as he's not missed. Then in the second tier, you begin to try to learn more, and you begin to learn about the different possibilities that could fill in the story further. You even finally murder the second husband in this chapter here, chapter 6. It's a very disappointing murder. In order to make the story legible, I had to drop him off a bridge, but I provide 50 other better murders from the newspapers, so you can decide what would be the more interesting way for him to die, and I add two suicides, just to be safe. In the third tier, you finally are ready to make this story, or movie, let's say, but then you have a problem. There are all these interesting characters that Molly never met, so you have to deal with them, right? Then you have all the places she didn't want to see that are more interesting than where she went. Then he discovered that she lived in a place where more movie murders took place than anywhere else in the history of noir cinema, but she hated crime movies. She only liked comedies. And then all these things that she forgot, and then so on, and cinematic zones of death, imaginary journeys through films that, well, I guess I can show a moment of one of those, and then we'll rush to the last part. And I'll stay on rhythm, more or less, confusing you, but on rhythm, right? Now let's go to the next one. Let's see, where would we be? We couldn't get the film rights, as you know, right?
In Rudolph Matte's 1950 DOA, the lead character, played by Edmund O'Brien, cruises down the dark Broadway Boulevard in downtown L.A. The camera lingers in front of the...
So I have this earnest graduate student who didn't realize how ridiculous it was, right?
In the film Heat, a group of highly organized criminals, led by Robert De Niro, rob an armored money truck beneath the 10 and 110 freeway interchanges. The crime is made possible
anyway,
with a stolen...
Anyway, this appeared in 2002. It's available in DVD-ROM and so on, and I have a new database novel twice the size that I'm working on now, and perhaps we should start talking about that. If we can move to that now. So Bleeding Through is available through Amazon, I guess. I'll show you the interface sketch of the... Well, first I'll talk about the new one. The new one is about 2,100 images. It's a journey through how the 20th century was imagined before it happened. Here, too, there's a kind of central character as a collective personality. There's a legend of a woman whose name was Carrie, a vast improvement in lifestyle over Dreiser's Carrie, just as Molly is the Molly who never blooms, right? This is a Carrie who makes it to the Dearborn station, more or less in one piece, right? And she does have a kind of crisis that she has a clinical, what we call a clinical depression, but it only makes her more dangerous because men are constantly trying to save her, right? So she's a very disarming sort of personality and doesn't quite know what to make of it. Her father is a kind of con man, and he makes this is an image from the 1893 World's Fair of someone falling asleep in Chicago. The story at the fair. The story begins in 1893, goes to various other places, and it will be opening at ZKM in October this year, and then in other places, and I'd be happy to bring it to London because I've discovered quite a lot about your world wars. Apparently, the English became obsessed with world wars. After 1871, they were determined to get ready for the Germans to invade London. They were constantly burning down and imagining. The World War of 1897 is well detailed. The World War of 1910. And on and on and on. I've gone through 70,000 images with the co-directors, Margot Bistis, who's the curator principally, and then Andreas Kratke, who's the designer principally, and so on. And so I have a lot to show you, but I'm going to do a kind of walk-through, talk-through, to give you a sense of how it might work. First, I'll show you the interface sketch. And that just, if you can just pull back quickly as I talk, each screen will does it move? I think it moves a little, doesn't it? If it doesn't move, it doesn't move. Yeah, there you go, get the sense. Look how quickly it happened. Quick experience. Anyway, that's all right. You'll have about 7 images together. They'll be keyworded in such a way that when you move in any of 3 or 4 directions, you can either follow the narrative or journey into the 4 worlds. Because in 1901, she is seduced by 4 men, each of them promising a version of the 20th century, of the future. It's Scheherazade in reverse. How it happens and where it goes is part of the story. Now, so you get a sense. The actual interface is being designed right now breathlessly by this Berliner named Andreas Kratke, who I hope is not sleeping at this moment. Yeah, he seems to never sleep, so that would be all right. But you get the spirit of how these large data fields will appear. Altogether, 2,100 images in a journey that will be curatorially accurate. Anyway, let's show you some of the images, and I'll talk over them. I won't tell you what they are. Too much time. No time. Right? This is the future. And so we'll go to the excerpt from the database, and then I'll begin. Right? I'll just talk over it. This is an image of how she is seen by other men. 1893, we see she begins in Chicago. Her journey through the Chicago World's Fair becomes an inspiration, almost scientifically and emotionally, that leads to a disastrous marriage with a sexual scandal that leaves her one of the luckiest women in America. She is left with enough money to survive. Her husband is a bastard. The family says that they'll pay for some money as long as she please never goes back to Chicago to embarrass their wealthy, shall we say, adventurous son. She decides to go to Europe to follow some interest that she has in, this is a French image, kind of great, huh? Happy divorce. Some image of what she thinks the future might look like. There she meets her first suitor, who takes her to Greece, where she joins the Signs and Crafts movement, which you may know about. Everyone nods because they're embarrassed to admit they don't know about it. It never existed. Bruce Sterling and I invented it. And in the Signs and Crafts movement, she experiences all these scientists more interested in sexual adventures and not bathing, and finds that it's almost like being in a mining camp. She has a nervous breakdown afterward and is followed by her first suitor, a Swiss businessman named Carl Friedrich, whose cousin Friedrich Carl is the financier for the Science and Crafts movement. And then during her nervous breakdown, she goes through a set of experiences near Vienna in a place that has no recognition or interest in Freud whatsoever, have their own therapeutic models. And she meets her second suitor, Otto Turner, and so begins the process of her therapeutic recovery, various kinds of electrical therapy, and a fascination with ISIS cults and theosophy. And on the way out, back to Southern California, where her uncle has left her 3 acres to relax in, she locates her two other suitors, an Algerian colon named Gaston Lesage, and then a New York anarchist named Hiram Barney, or High Barney, right? They wind up here in the San Gabriel Valley and begin the process of imagining the 20th century for 9 months until they realize they have no idea, right, where they're going, but they're continuing to proceed anyway. And then after that, in 1908, all these images have so much history behind them. She winds up in New York and shoots a man. It doesn't go to trial, but she becomes a legend. And in fact, she is actually the bride stripped bare in the Duchamp Great Glass. She, of course, discovers that being a bride stripped bare is a legend. Even if you survive shooting a man, it's not worth it. It's better to be the bachelor. So she's the bride stripped bare who decides she'd prefer to be the bachelor. But these are images of New York in the early 19s. She's in Greenwich Village when it's still an Italian neighborhood. Then we witness her again once more in 1913 when she's in pursuit for the last time for a second husband. She's been persuaded she can try one more time. She does indeed locate a second husband, a kind of rancher farmer in the San Fernando Valley who lives near Edgar Rice Burroughs. This is High Barney in Mexico. He follows her. And High Barney has a rather grim version of the future, as you can imagine. She gets involved in flying and aeronautics because women are invited in the early teens to actually fly. Here's a man who just appears all at once. And that this is one of the classic images related to the piece. And this gives you a sense of some of the worlds. This is Gaston became fascinated with the fact that almost all versions of the moon written by Verne and others resembled the North Africa he knew. So in fact, the moon was Africa and all liminal spaces. And he invents a kind of failed novel about the journey to the liminal versions of his own fantasies of French imperialism. Then the second is Carl Friedrich's confusion about the future city. This is and all the possible escapes from the dense, very, very, very modern megacities like London and New York, and what alternatives were imagined. This is before futurism. These are all from fairly common sources that the middle class read in magazines. Then the third world is preparing for the future total war and the crisis that people had that women, socialism, and world war were going to happen with the same disastrous result. The paranoia was enormous. Here's some of the paranoia right here. This is visions in the 1880s of what the world war would look like. Not bad. This is Robidas. And then finally, Otto Turner's version of the future. He decides to try to examine what the human body would have to be to handle all the pressures of the future, a body without fatigue, a body that never tired, a body that could handle the stresses and strains of this dynamic and dangerous future. And I think there are a few more images, and I'll wager I almost am precisely on time, right? How's that? Half an hour journey. We'll look at a few more. These are some of the paranoid. That's a paranoid German image. Oh, this is some of the treatments to get your body ready, to electricity through your body parts. I just have a strong feeling it didn't work. I would not have used it. Some of the paranoia about the female of the future, right? You begin to get a sense that men are very worried. The exercise machines, the strange visions of cities that will float in the air, some way for the bourgeoisie to escape the inevitable, but they won't. Anyway, I think that's it. Yes. Am I at a half an hour? I bet you have some questions.
Yeah, well, I can't stop smiling. And that was, I mean, thank you for not, you could have gone on for hours. And I'm sure that database novel goes on for hours depending
yes,
on what you
actually,
do.
Yes, actually, when I delivered a version of this in Paris, they made me stay for another half an hour. But then they still ignored me afterward, you know, French fresh. You know,
well, I think what we'll do is we'll take some questions. Got one right there.
All right. I have a question to put to Norman Klein, but which is also related, I think, to your talk about the relation between the frozen and the fluid states. But it was particularly prompted by the last thing that Norman said earlier on when he talked about the danger of losing the mental processes in between spaces, states, yes. Keyframes. It reminded me of a similar concern from Sean Cubitt. He talks about the insistence in new media and software to produce an instantaneous result. You know that in computation it's about procedures, you know, you go through things step by step, but very, very quickly. And that process must be sort of elided and made to disappear. So you press the search button, you get the results there. You press the upload, you must immediately get it. Yeah. You press the send button, the person you hope gets it immediately at the other end. Do you think that there is a relation between that and what you were saying? Do you think we should reanimate new media?
Well, Among all the friends I know and work with in new media, what I find very strange is, at first one imagines it actually speeds up your process, and then I see that zombie look on their face months later and discover that for some reason, not to borrow the term hypnagogic, right, they become completely obsessed with polishing it, whether it's a jelly bean, a diamond, an old sandwich, they just keep going. And it's almost difficult to allow them to structurally edit and step back. There's something so mentally overwhelming about that cybernetic relationship that I think we almost lose that sense of distance. And Western culture is so much built around that sense of distance and dialectic. And part of it is this crisis about public and private inverting, that we need to almost find a way to rediscover possibilities. So I think it looks instantaneous, but it's actually endless and relentless. It's a relentless version of the instantaneous. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably agree with that so much of it is about the disappointment, isn't it? And about waiting then, which is the dead time. The zombie time, but which can't, in a way, shrink because of the way that the increased processing powers, you know, go on. So more and more needs to be done. So the waiting doesn't disappear. But I suppose how that annexes to what you were saying about the bit in, you know, is that dead space of waiting the same as the break between frames wherein lies the possibility of reflection, and it doesn't seem to be so.
It was relatively quick, the almost instantaneous. Is that?
Yeah, that's sort of the drive that the search process, for instance, has to be. Yes. You know, it's not really a search. You just get the results. There they are.
And it's also the myth of free will in a world of absolute predestination, as I call it. Right?
Yes.
You have this feeling that you're actually in charge of something, and the only thing you're in charge of is your own bill.
Google
is
already
which will arrive,
sold
I can
results.
Tell you right now. And someone might even take your banking identity at the same time. I want to.
Yes,
if someone would like to work
see.
With me, I'd love to make a computer game called Theft, where all you do is steal people's financial identity, right? The entire game, you know, and then you go into hell or something like that. I mean, there is this. It's almost a replacement for the fact of democratic egalitarian process. You have this feeling that you're actually acting on the world, and you're in Second Life, right? Mm-hmm. You're not acting on the world, and I think it's generated a very strange but fascinating form of alienation, which should be able to make novels for the next 500 years. We are so confused. We should surely have enough material, don't you think, right?
So I would. We've got a question down here.
Oh, yes, Tom? Oh, no, someone. Oh, the microphone is coming.
Waiting time.
Oh, what? There's the waiting time.
You know, I find this so fascinating, but what immediately occurs to me is how profoundly, and I mean this in the best sense, 19th century, turn of the century it is, yes. And that it's very much like D.W. Griffith's Intolerance, you know, which is a film that tries to tell four different stories of four different versions of the past and then envision a kind of future at the very end. And, of course, what's fascinating about that film is it's been universally dumped upon and considered intolerable. I once, when I was in Uruguay...
Except the Russians, right, who loved it.
Well, a few, but apparently they really liked watching Peril of Pauline. They,
really? But, is that true?
And in fact, when I was in Uruguay, they showed me a cartoon where a mother's admonishing her naughty child and saying, be good or I'll take you to see Intolerance. but what I was going to ask about, I mean, Griffith's metaphor for Intolerance was, he said, it's as though I'm on a mountain and I can see all these different phases of history all around me. And when I was going over this, what seemed to be a rather bizarre metaphor for many years in teaching, it wasn't until the computer age suddenly emerged that my students all said, that makes sense.
And what I'm wondering is whether the kind of fantasy of universal access that the cyber world gives us is, in fact, this amazing fulfillment or hellish fulfillment, perhaps, of the utopia of the 19th century that actually, you know, all of those years that kind of we grew up were just kind of marking time because it seemed to be a totally different view of the future. Yeah. And that suddenly we're reviving one that really was from the period that your novel set.
Yeah, that's partly why I'm doing that, is to bring up discussions like this. But I was wondering if you had any comments.
No, I was just thinking, as Tom was speaking there, about sort of steampunk and that, you know, difference engines and so on, that, you know, going back to the origins of SF to see its future imaginings.
Those who don't know about it, right, you want to explain steampunk? Because it's... I don't have any expertise on it. It's just that it began, in a way, from... am I echoing? Am I right? Again, it was actually Bruce Sterling and others, right? And they wrote this novel about Babbage, and imagining that the steam engine continued, and the electricity was held back, and the computer started, and so a kind of parallel alternative world, which is very common in our science fiction era now, because we have such a kind of chunky peanut butter version of horizontalized culture, this niching that globalization does. It's really glocalization is really what's happening. And this idea of multitasking, right? Really, what I guess we're now able to multitask. I sometimes say as a joke, which of course I'm always filled with jokes, but the world may not seem deep, but it's definitely shallow and wide, right? And that's not a bad thing. you have some new challenges. So I do think... in balance, your comment made me imagine that we have to understand that whatever critiques we have are supposed to be there, because unless we have critiques, we have no discourse, we have no content, we have nothing. But there really are some opportunities to re-engage. And the 19th century was about engagement, and in a sense it was about modernity. And something about this culture seems to disengage us to such a degree, particularly speaking as an American, you know, after being Bushismo'd, you know, for the last... I've been horrified. You know, the Vatican of Vegas, the last chapter, Bush is a Baroque special effect. But I wrote that for a German newspaper while the election was going on. It took me about 19 seconds, you know, and he would appear in my dreams intact as George W. Bush, just walking through my brain at night. And so it's speaking about the American experience in particular, watching this disengagement and this tremendous drive to not do that and to relocate. If we have to find points of origin in the late 19th century in all of its perversities, now that we know what it brought, that so much the better. We have to really, really imagine that we are in a race, in a race to invent a culture that's powerful enough to even connect with what's coming, which is going to be large, very large.
Okay, I'll see if there's any other questions, because I'm sure there's a few other questions, maybe for Esther. I would have one if there's nothing out there yet. No. I guess it's more not so much a question as a... you brought up this idea of a digital sublime, which I think is a perfect description of the frozenness that people experience when they're confronted by it. And I've kind of got two questions. I guess the one would be, you mentioned a distrust of the sublime, which in my understanding of it is an emotive reaction to something that actually freezes you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you'd like to comment on that. And the other is the idea of the screen. And with working with digital screens, the maker is now in front of a screen as they're making. I don't know, because we had this discussion about screens on the telephone. Mm. I don't know if you'd like to extrapolate in terms of what you were talking about before.
Yeah. Help me think. I mean, yeah, I think it's... eventually, I mean, I voice it as a distrust of the sublime. And for me, although that's not... it's not necessarily what one would take from a Kantian reading, because within Kant, the sublime, in the end, reinforces our intellectual reasoning and the fact that we can withstand this overwhelming experience, and somehow we are rattled, but we contain it within our mind. I suppose I transpose ideas of the sublime into Benjamin's idea of the aura, I suppose, and it becomes sort of through my paper more a signifier of that which distances us, forces us into contemplation, and as you say, immobilizes us as actors, and just traps us in this spatialized relationship outside of time. But it may be there's a kind of wandering in the concept, and I need to think a little more about this, because this is pulled together partly sort of in response to things I've seen here, so it's a bit sort of puked out of my head or something. But
it is important for us to slow down vision enough to see that. It looks like Vivian wants to say something.
Yes. I wanted to raise the question of time and history here, because both of your papers deal, you know, very directly with it in different ways. Esther, your discussion of frozen time, particularly, and this sort of reading backward to the 19th century. I mean, I have seen Bleeding Through, Norman, and it's quite extraordinary. And yes, there is a relation in a way to the multiple stories of intolerance, but clearly the simultaneity or the near simultaneity, which brings you to that in between. Which is both the in-between of frames, the in-between of action. I kept, when you mentioned that in the earlier questioner, I kept thinking of, you know, the digital watch. I don't wear one. I like to watch the secondhand sweep. There is this, the instant time. So what does that mean, even, instant time? Yes. Time is duration. So there seems to be in both of these projects and considerations of these two papers, a real sense of a loss of time, or the desire to find it again somewhere, or it's what got lost in the in-between.
Yes.
And I remember seeing a very funny cartoon. I mean, it's tragic, actually. A Dennis the Menace, an American cartoon figure of a little bratty boy in the kitchen with his mother asking, "Mommy, why can't we fast forward the microwave?" And you know, that gives one, dare I say, pause. I mean, it seems like, you know, the possibility of history, but in a very existential way also, the living of time. We have speed, we have space. Where's time?
That's such a large question. First of all, is it possible that the 250-year journey we identify as the Enlightenment forward ended? I have this vision in my mind, the kind of Socratic question. Someone walks up to someone in 1975 and says, "Did you know the Enlightenment just ended?" And that means that the political logic of the Enlightenment, everything, the whole Western episode is over, right? And we're just sort of drifting into something else. We have no sense of historical structure to explain the moment now. And art historians are having this problem. Museum curators are having this problem. Historians and the post-structuralists warned us of this problem. But now we've passed the barrier. We're dropping into a well, and we have to confront what on earth, you know, we have to really deal with what that means. All that obsession with time and the instantaneous, right? What if it's so instantaneous that we don't even worry anymore? What if it's not time but space? I mean, it's easy to be talking to three continents at once. I have no trouble. I email people in Helsinki. I'm talking to someone in Germany. I'm listening to the news. I'm watching, reading the paper, and I don't have a nervous breakdown, right? But it seems like space, as I understood it, right, the cities are turning into suburbs, right? The inside is turning into the outside. We don't have an unconscious, only really good medication, right? And we seem to have inverted so many things in strange ways that I think the crisis of space is almost more powerful than the crisis of time in a way. But you would say no.
Can you see if you might have something
yes.
to add to this as well? a Kairos pilot. I think what is getting lost is not so much anything which has to do with duration or whatever goes into this direction. It's the sensitivity for the moment.
Yes.
Machines can't deal with that. They can't. No. They can create the illusion, and this is very much about animation.
Yes.
They can create the illusion that you can extend the moment. But they really can't deal with the moment because the moment is not existing. It's not calculable. You can't put it into any formalization. And I think this is worth to think about. The old Greeks were seeing this problem into which they came when they just had two concepts of time. Chronos, chronology,
yes.
A time we don't have, which has us. And on the other hand, Aeon, which is that which we can call the machine time, perhaps. It's the time which we can't imagine, eternity, the infinite, and so on. And in between, there was this youngest god, the moment, Kairos, which you have to grasp. Long hair in the front, bold hair in the back. So if it's past, it's gone forever. And I think this kind of sensitivity for the moment, which no machine can give
no.
us, is something we have to.
No, I admit also to being a happy dinosaur, right? And missing all sorts of ridiculous things that I have to get over, deal with my therapist, and, you know, clear it away. But this disengaged sensation, which I think is what we're all sensing, which is so culturally dangerous, has to be. If we can't solve it, we should at least relish living through it. I have this other joke I often use in lectures, that 100 years from now, children will dress as Americans for Halloween, you know? And I feel that we should just move forward a little bit, you know, and enjoy it now, right? And start moving onto the problem and problematize as far as we have to try to regain, right, or recapture that sense of the momentary irony, right? And it does seem that we have a culture that stretches it, that manipulates it, that industrializes our sleep. Is there any other culture that wants to make money off of you while you're sleeping and wants to make money off of your children while they're kicking a soccer ball or something? It's it's quite mad. But the madness is so interesting, right? So we have to slow it down and attack it. So any question that brings that out, as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather see the omelet, right? And then we'll worry about scooping it back into the egg later. You know, right now, I think we should.
Can I
you? Yes,
you
please.
Know, just a sec. Maybe I think
I mean, the moment. I want to hold on to a sense of the moment as momentous as that which is significant, which means it has meaning for people, and that means a possibility of intervening in it or engaging or something. And I suppose all of this was kicked off partly by seeing a rush of films about iciness and so on, but also just that wondering what that experience of time slice is, what it does to us watching, and why, to me, it isn't like Eisenstein stretching time and space on the Odessa step sequence or the bridge sequence, which, you know, equally is drawing out time, but this is a momentous moment in which we are forced through multi-perspectivalism or asked through multi-perspectivalism to consider its significance and significance for us, whereas the synthetic wonder of the time slice and so on, it seems to me to be marshaled to ends which are precisely about walling us out and making us impervious to almost like a little object that Benjamin loved, you know, the snow shaker, a globe thing, a fully contained world which will exist without our presence within it, I suppose.
Done. I think you've got another question.
Hi. I just wanted to make a point that I thought connected both of these papers really well, which was about the spatialization of time. And this also connects with Vivian Sobchak's work. Merleau-Ponty, in The Phenomenology of Perception, talks about our experience of time as starting with the body and being experienced in space. And I'm sort of connecting this with your idea of the time slice, but it also made me think of lots of far older things like cubism, like I don't know if everybody's seen Antonioni's film Zabriskie's Point, which is there's an explosion and it's slowed down in time, and lots of different camera viewpoints from all around are shown, so it's almost like a time slice. And the other thing I was thinking about was Cornelia Parker's installation of the exploded shed, which I think came before this time slice, or it might have been at the same time. So I was interested if you wanted to expand a bit on this idea of the narrative environment as well as the spatialization of time.
Well, do you want to start? Well, first this reference to cubism, I'm sort of obsessed with, probably because of Vivian, the morph. She forced me to slow down my hyperstimulated personality, whatever it is that I am, to sort of look at the morph itself. And I began to ask myself, what is the difference between the morph and the collage? I became obsessed with this as a kind of narrative thing. And I had this student who actually is at AA now, Zach Kais, do a little drawing of it. It became interesting to me that the morph is almost like layers of space, sort of in some continuum, and the collage was, it's a matter of degree, of course, is even more about the simultaneity of time. So it's just part of my current obsession that we have to rediscover what this crisis is, what sense of loss we have. And I guess I feel the loss of experience in space, in the tangible momentary space, is so colossally, you know, dangerous, particularly in a world like ours, that I can't help emphasizing it. But I love the idea of us orbiting around the problem, because I think all these questions are bringing us closer to perhaps generating what I would hope would be the ultimate result of a process like this, to find new forms that are not new in the sense that they've never historically happened, but are new because they're actually engaging the moment. Because the moment seems to be actually the political and moral crisis. So I think all these questions are extremely useful if we promise to think about them for the next 15 months, you know, stuff like that. Right?
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about the Cornelia Parker, that trying to think about that in relation to this, and that embodiment of an explosion is, I would have thought, an effort to three-dimensionalize the power of photography and the split second and the dynamiting of the frame. Benjamin says film brings into being, and it's a sort of vision of that. I think there's an extra layer added on to that once you get this mobility that's done to you. And I suppose that's the thing that interests me, that your body experiences or is made to experience a mobility, which is just a sort of another version of immobilization. I think with the Cornelia Parker, if that's set within a gallery, you enter into the frame. It's like entering into the frame of a photograph in a different way and maybe moving around it. But I think it's a really interesting comparison.
I think what might be an idea would be to do a very, very brief kind of roundup of, not of what's been discussed, because happily it's all been web archived, so if you fell asleep or missed anything or couldn't be here, you can go back and visit it. I know I'm going to do that an awful lot, and I'm sure all of you will as well. And I think without making any kind of revisitation or summing together of the incredibly disparate, in the best possible sense of the word, ideas that have been presented here and discoveries that have been made by, well, I'd say to a certain degree, people that weren't expecting to make them, is something really to be said for the quality of thinking and risk-taking of all of our speakers. And I just really want to thank them so much in the first instance for coming here and sharing some just ideas that are going to, I think, generate so much thinking and engagement with whatever this thing is that we call animation. I know I'm going to think about it very differently after this, and I think a lot of us will. And that's a good thing, because it doesn't really mean anything in the words that's been used about it. Stuart, would you like to say thank you to everyone else?
To all of you. To Suzanne, again, I think I'd wanted to have an animation conference for quite a while at Tate, and this was exactly the one I'd hoped for, so I can't thank you enough, Suzanne. And to Max Zoller and Ms. Sunday Lutetta, who helped us immensely. And most of all, to our AV staff and our projectionists, Michael, Al, Lauren, and David, who did a superb job over the last few days. And again, to all the speakers, who I think your contribution was really great. So thanks so much.